This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello and welcome to today's podcast for Afternoons with Helen Farmer. As you can hear, I'm not Helen, I'm Jen Crichton. I am filling in and we had a packed show today. First up, we were talking about cultural stereotypes and how they affect us, particularly at work. A lot of you got in touch on this one about how sort of multiculturalism presents itself within your teams. We had two experts with us on that topic. It was a fascinating conversation. We also today were discussing discipline for kids. We were joined by parenting coach Aisha Mohammed, who talked to us on the back of a UNICEF study about parental attitudes to discipline and how we sometimes get discipline confused with punishment. We also learned about epigenetics, or in layman's terms, the way our experiences can change our genetic makeup and how we can pass trauma on to our kids. And we looked at the big millionaire migration because there's a super rich swarm headed for Dubai. We wondered, what is it going to mean for life here? We put that to concierge to the rich, Thea Kearse. A busy show indeed. We hope you enjoy it.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm jumping right in at the deep end here, I'll be honest. Very intriguing topic, multiculturalism. Now, I know what you're thinking. We've got 200 nationalities here in the UAE. We've got this nailed. But a new book suggests that in our very global workplaces, miscommunication is still pretty commonplace. And I want you to be honest here. Do you make assumptions about people based on their nationalities? I think probably to a degree we all do. Might not want to admit it, but this is a no judgment zone. Let me know. Do you think that you do that? 4001 on the text. We're going to be getting into essentially what this means for us in the workplace, especially here, and how we can perhaps avoid the pitfalls of stereotyping a bit. So to get into the topic, I'm joined in the studio by two experts. Emma Jordan's the CEO at Infinite Consulting, and Ing Van Bell is a partner in executive search and assessment at Stanton Chase. Hello to both of you. Thank you for coming in. Emma, I'm coming to you first. Tell me what you mean by cultural stereotyping. How would we see it kind of present itself here in the UAE?
I think when we, you know, put people in particular boxes and we say all of the people from this particular nationality are like this, and we then make assumptions on their capability. Often when it's somebody that's not from our own culture, we might label them as incompetent, when actually it's just a misunderstanding in terms of, you know, they might be approaching something in the workplace in an entirely different way to us. And often we think our way is the right way, right? So when somebody tackles something in an entirely different way to us, we then think, okay, well, you know, they obviously don't know what they're doing and they must be incompetent.
Is that something you would agree with, Ing? Is that kind of how you see it on your side of things when it comes to looking at people and sort of perhaps judging a bit based on their nationality?
Yes, I think stereotyping is only natural. It's also a cognitive tool for ourselves, and we use it very often to simplify and to process information quite fast and efficiently. So I think stereotyping, although it has a negative connotation, can also be a benefit for us. And why do we always think that stereotyping is something negative? It can also be something positive, like saying, okay, people that are from Switzerland are very timely, or Italian people are good in design, or Indians are good at maths. So it can also be something that we use in a positive way, it can also help us to put people on the right place, of course, so, on the condition that we don't generalize, of course.
Yeah, I mean, from my own information, I guess my initial thought is culture the same as nationality? When we're like in this conversation, is all of the sort of cultural stereotyping that we see going on here, is it based on nationality or is it wider than that? Emma?
Yeah, I think so our cultural upbringing is what typically determines the way that we behave, and obviously that then impacts the way that we are in the workplace. So your nationality will ultimately have a huge impact on that. Having said that, though, the way that we're brought up as a child can then be further influenced by the experiences that we have in our adult life. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that we would naturally conform to the cultural upbringing that we were exposed to. We may then later in life determine what are the cultural values that we're going to hold dear to.
And so where do those values come from, would you say? What should we be aware of when we're trying to consider that?
So we're not born with culture. It's something that's taught to us either through our parents or our wider family, or even our schooling and our education, you know, all of the things that we're exposed to as we're growing up. So I think that's what determines our culture. But as I said, later in life, we can then say, okay, well, you know, based on having moved from my own country to another country like the UAE, I'm now having a much broader perspective and recognise that I actually align more to another type of view on something and on a topic. And therefore, I'm kind of falling a little bit away from my, you know, my national cultural values, if you like.
So, Ing, when it comes to recruiting and the workplace side of things, yes, how would we see this play out? Where do these kind of cultural influences come into the workforce?
Yeah, so national culture, just as Emma just said, is something that has been programmed. And of course, when we recruit, it is a useful tool, but at the same time, something that we really have to watch out for. But when we look at culture, we always say it's some kind of it's a group phenomenon. And we use the word culture to analyze behavior of people and also sometimes to predict behavior of people. So national culture does come in when we recruit, and in some countries outside of this region, it would be not, let's say, very proper to say so, but we do use it here, especially when we look at leaders, because of course, if you look at a leader, leader is defined by many other things too. Of course, first of all, by his or her competences, also by his or her behavior, leadership behavior. But culture for us, especially at my company, Stanton Chase, is a very useful tool, not to judge, but mainly to see if that person can actually fit into the culture of the organization. So there's a clear distinction between a national culture and organizational culture. And of course, you are always, let's say, impregnated with your own national culture, but that doesn't mean that you are not adaptable. So what we do is, even though you've got your imprints, we really look at how adaptable is this leader for this organization. And very often so, to see if it works, if there's a match, it is because there is a cultural match between both parties, between the employer and the employee.
Emma, how does our kind of cultural upbringing and background influence how we lead? Is it something that we need to be aware of working in such a global environment as we are here?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely does need to be something that we're aware of. Our cultural background can determine, you know, how hierarchical we are, how we perceive time, how do we build relationships, how do, you know, even things like the way that we negotiate in a sales capacity. So it influences absolutely every aspect of our life. And so you may have a leader from one culture that would lead in one way, and a leader from another culture that would lead in an entirely different way. Often we've assumed that perhaps it's just their personality, when actually it's deeper ingrained. You know, it's to do with their cultural upbringing that's determined the way that they might behave in the workplace.
That's really interesting. So are some kind of cultures less hierarchical than others then? And do we bring that with us into the workplace?
Yeah, so some cultures would be more hierarchical. So there would be an expectation that, you know, you respect the senior person, what they says go, you know, decisions are made top down, and you wouldn't necessarily want to kind of share your ideas or kind of share any level of initiative with the leader, because it would be potentially seen as calling into question their leadership style or their authority. Whereas other cultures, more flatter cultures, quite appreciate the collaboration of the team. You know, we'll all sit around a table and we'll discuss our ideas. And then, yes, the leader will still make the overall decision, but we've together made that decision as a group. And when you're working with people that are at the opposite end of the scale to yourself, then you'll probably notice quite a big difference.
Inga, how does that play into when it comes to building teams? Because I assume there's no right or wrong way, but there's a right or wrong fit, perhaps.
Yes, indeed. And as Emma pointed out, it's really about awareness and about communication. And if we have conflicts or misunderstandings in the workplace, it's mainly because of that, because of the expectations of a team leader, of the team. They expect to get clear directions and clear guidelines, whereas the leader thinks, oh, I'm just giving them the freedom because I want to empower them. And this is where a lot of misunderstandings start to exist. Now, a way to actually help that is by just training people and raising that cultural awareness. And of course, there's some very nice coaches, like, for example, Emma, who can help you with that. So it's awareness, it's training, and this is when we recruit leaders. Almost every organization here in the UAE asks us, like, please bring a leader in, whatever personality, whatever nationality, but a leader that knows how it works in this region, because this region is different compared to others.
And I mean, in what way is this region different? Would you say that there's a kind of norm in this region and the way that we expect to see people lead?
Well, Dubai is an international, it's a global business hub. We have so many nationalities working together. So a norm, I would not say that there's a norm. Also, there's so many different organization cultures. But what we do see is that actually you need to have that leadership experience to be an inclusive leader. Otherwise, you will never be able to stick around and be successful.
And so, Emma, what does inclusive leadership look like here? How would you go about training somebody to be more inclusive in their leadership style?
So for me, the very first step is to do an exercise of introspection. So that would be a cultural intelligence assessment where the leader is then able to better understand their own cultural values, because often we don't understand what it is that's driving our behaviour. So once you understand that better, you can then start to see the similarities and the differences between yourself and your colleagues, and then start to think about how can you put strategies in place in order that those interactions with your colleagues are more effective, because you recognise that there are challenges that you're going to face because you'll tackle something in an entirely different way to one another.
I think it's so interesting. Like, my husband here is managing teams in three different countries. And he was saying at the beginning, the biggest adjustment was trying to get some of the staff to speak up in meetings and others to kind of leave room for those people to speak up. And I guess in that way, it's not even just about culture. It's a lot of the time it's about character, right? It's some people will always feel more confident in stepping forward, and others might be more confident in the background just following. Is it about encouraging people to be themselves, or is it about kind of teasing out the areas where people might be stepping back themselves?
So I think there is an element of character or personality that determines whether somebody's going to speak up or not. You know, are they extroverted or introverted? But on a deeper level, in terms of culture, you know, people that come from hierarchical cultures are less likely to speak up unless they're kind of invited to do so. And then also, as long as they feel confident that what they say isn't going to be potentially used against them, whereas other cultures will feel completely confident to share their views. And that's where you get that whole some people kind of take over the meeting and others will just almost sit in silent. I suppose the issue then comes when it's assumed that those that have been silent were kind of shy and more reserved and had nothing to say, when in actual fact they may have a lot to say, but they just don't necessarily know that it's appropriate to share their views and their, you know, their input.
Someone has messaged in, they've not put their name on this actually, but they said different nationalities here are a constant eye opener. My own most bewildering thing is the fact that while I will try and join conversations, there are others who, when you walk past and you're having a conversation, will duck their heads. Are they expecting a sniper? It's interesting. I wonder if that's a shyness thing. I would kind of be inclined to sort of join a conversation as well, but I understand that kind of temptation to sort of offer people privacy, I guess, if they're walking past you having a conversation. I'm not sure if that's a cultural thing or if that's a personality thing, but I guess it kind of touches on what, Inga, you were saying before the break, is that we have these kind of cultural differences. We have our own personality differences. You made a really interesting point just before we went into the break there, which was actually a lot of these differences are something we should be building on and celebrating rather than trying to smooth out. Where can those differences be positive and what degree of friction is good?
Indeed, for me personally, I'm always looking at organizations and I'm sometimes really surprised to see how civil everyone is with each other. We are all afraid to make any faux pas because we are all respectful to each other. But being respectful is not how you make a breakthrough team. If you really want to spark innovation, you will have to have some kind of friction. And of course, it's up to your specific team, your specific organization, how much friction and how much innovation you can allow, and depending on your industry too. So for me, especially when I look at the workspace here in Dubai or in the UAE in general, I also see that, let's say 10, 15 years ago, we looked at it from an expat point of view. Well, this is just a temporary stop. It's a transient market. So we're not going to invest too much into employee relations with our colleagues. But really, when we look now, people are staying for longer and it's much more sustainable in terms of people. So now we're much more investing in that kind of team dynamics. And this is something, if you really want to have those good team dynamics, then we will have to have these open and honest conversations with each other, whether we like it or not.
And so what level of friction is, I guess, healthy in a team? Where is that a positive and where does it cross the line into, okay, we've maybe got a bit of an issue here?
Huh. It's a very difficult question, Jennifer, because it really depends on the specific culture in your organization. So then we would have to go back to the organizational culture. What kind of organization do you want to be? Do you want to be an innovative organization or do you want to be more traditional? There's no judgment there. We only say like, okay, make sure whatever culture or you have, just make sure that it's very clear. We always say like your vibe attracts your tribe. So the more specific you are about your culture, the easier it will become for you to attract the right employees and the right team members. And then you will have that team dynamics and it should be something that is quite natural and fluid too. And it's the task of the leader to navigate through that.
I love that phrase, your vibe attracts your tribe. I wonder though, this is maybe a bit of a controversial one, but you hear a lot of people saying to get ahead in the UAE, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Is there an element in this where we kind of build teams in our own image, where we look for people that think like us and end up getting a bit siloed? Emma, is that a risk here?
I mean, so firstly, I would agree that yes, in this region, it's not what you know, it's who you know. But I would argue that that's to do with, again, culture. Probably about 70% of the population here come from cultures that are typically more relationship orientated, which would mean that the focus would be on that, building that human connection with the other person in order you can decide, do I like them and therefore do I want to do business with them, or you know, do I want to refer their CV to my employer? But I mean, yes, there is an element of which you end up being surrounded by people like yourself. For me, one of the things that I, you know, try to strive to do is look at, you know, who am I surrounded by? Who am I regularly talking to? Do they look like me? Do they sound like me? And try and make sure that that's a broad spectrum of people so that I've got a broad perspective of different culture and not always just looking at things from my own perspective and having my mind open to different ways of doing things. It doesn't mean, as Inga was saying, it doesn't mean that there won't be those levels of as friction because nobody likes being told that their way is not the right way, right? But recognising that friction you know, that friction will be there because we do approach things differently from a cultural perspective. But then thinking about what are the strategies that we can put in place in order that we're more effective when we are tackling things in entirely different ways, so that the job can still get done and so that everybody within the organisation still feels valued and heard. I think for me, it's just about how can we show more grace to one another. You know, as an example, now, one of the things that I witness is that when I'm delivering training, I can have a multitude of different nationalities attending the training course, and there'll be different people arriving at different times. And that will be to do with the perspective people have around the value of time. And in the past, because I come from a culture that's typically more punctual, when people arrived late, I definitely didn't have so much grace. And I just thought, gosh, you don't value my time. And but actually, when you start to recognise the cultural value differences and you say, oh, okay, some people just see time in a much more fluid way and they're much more flexible with their time. It doesn't need to be so structured. And so if I arrive 5 or 10 minutes later to a meeting or a training course, it isn't an issue. I then, as the trainer, go, oh yeah, okay, that's all right now.
Gosh, that's a really interesting one, because I think I've been a bit like that. I've been a bit kind of judgmental, I guess, of lateness. But I feel like I've been sort of forced to learn to accept it in myself as well here, because we spend quite a bit of time stuck in traffic, and I find that even with the best will, I'm later here more often than I might be at home, and kind of having to make your peace with that. But I've never really thought of it as being a cultural thing. It's very interesting. I mean, going back to what you were saying about trying not to be surrounded by people who look and sound like you. I mean, Inga, when it comes to building teams, is that a key thing that you should be looking at, going, where do we have gaps in terms of our diversity in the team, and should we be looking to fill those?
Yes, absolutely. For me, I mean, it's a human reflex to, especially when you're recruiting as a leader, that you look for people who think like you, who are quite, you have a personality that's close to you. It's a general truth. It's not just here in the region. But here there's an extra layer, of course, because we tend to look at people with a similar background as ourselves. And actually, there's nothing wrong with that, because you think of the success of your organization. So you look at what person would help us reach that success. Oh, it would be somebody who thinks like us, who can speaks the same language, literally or by figure of speech. And so we can actually achieve success on a short-term basis. But of course, we have to look at the long-term basis. And if we just look at diversity and skills, then we, as a good leader, you always look for people who are actually smarter than yourself, at least in one or two areas. And this is actually what you should be looking for. So it's not just about the background, it's also about the skills. And this is what a fantastic leader would do. And diversity is a huge element, a crucial element in that.
You are currently, Inga, writing a book in this kind of region of expertise and talking about particularly employee engagement. And we've been talking quite a bit about leadership in this chat, but what does it mean for employee engagement? How do we bring employees into this conversation around diversity?
It's called employee engagement. What else? Because we want to bring best practices from marketing into the internal organization. So when we look at employee engagement, we've identified 12 drivers or killers of engagement. Leadership is actually the most important one, and it's quite universal. But quite recently, like in the past 5 to 10 years, diversity and inclusion is one of the drivers of engagement too. And there are some recent studies that show that the higher the diversity in your organization, the more chances that your organization is also super engaged.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's good news, actually. So this means that here in Dubai, with all these diverse organizations, we can actually have a very high engagement level. It's also something, I think it's a unique opportunity for this region to again to lead the way and show the world how it's done.
And so what does really good employee engagement look like?
Good employee engagement is when people feel emotionally, physically, and really attached to their employer. So engagement, employee engagement, is not the same as job satisfaction. And it's also not the same as well-being at work, because a lot of people think, oh, I'm happy at work and I'm actually quite satisfied with my job. That doesn't mean that they're engaged. There's enough examples of people who take it very easy and who think that they're at the Club Mediterranean when they go to work. But that's not really, it's not because you have a pool table at work that you're engaged. Engaged is much more than that.
Do you think there's an easy mistaking those two things? Do you think too many companies perhaps think that because they've got a pool table in the lobby and their staff look like they're having fun, that they have engaged employees?
Absolutely. It's it's one of my things, right? I really tell a lot of organizations how to increase that engagement, and employees that are being heard, employees that are being challenged, where they also have a safe environment and where employees can really learn and develop themselves. These are very important parameters of an engaged organization. And then, of course, there's the purpose and values. As long as employees feel that they're part of something that is bigger than themselves, then you've got a pretty good chance that they are engaged.
And Emma, when you go into companies to work with them on, sort of to consult with them, is that something that a lot of companies appreciate? Do you think that they see the benefit in having genuinely, truly engaged employees?
I think they understand that it's important. I don't think they necessarily appreciate always how much it can impact the bottom line. If you think about cultural intelligence, if you want to have a culturally inclusive workforce or workplace, so that everybody's engaged, you need to make sure that you've got the right strategies in place. But once you have those strategies in place and that you have then an engaged workforce, you can definitely see the benefits. You'll have a much more productive workforce, and therefore you'll see a much better return on investment.
Now, we've had a couple of messages in. One person says, if timeliness can be explained by culture, then every Glaswegian could be excused for showing up late to an interview. Besmirching the Glaswegians there. I'm glad I'm from Edinburgh. This cultural debate topic, says someone else, goes well beyond the workplace. Even the medical profession here in the UAE sometimes makes decisions and assumptions based on their perceived ideas of people. I think cultural awareness training is needed in a lot of sectors. That is another topic that I suspect we could probably talk about for hours, because I think it is. I mean, cultural awareness training, Emma, does it work? Is it, or we need to go a bit deeper than that?
I think cultural awareness training helps people to be aware of a particular culture. That doesn't necessarily mean you're intelligent about that culture. And cultural intelligence takes it that one step further, where you think about, how am I going to put strategies in place that makes me more effective when I'm working with other people? So for me, cultural intelligence is the way forward.
And if people want to find out more about what you do, Emma, where can they find you?
So the website is infiniteconsultingme.com, but I'm also on LinkedIn, Emma Jordan with a double A.
And Inga, when is that book coming out? When can I get my hands on it?
Okay, so I promised myself that I'm not going to jump on a plane as long as my book is not finished. So my children are going away for vacation. My husband is already gone, but I'm still stuck here. So I'm putting some pressure on myself. But I think during the summer it will be finished. So I'll certainly invite you over for the book launch.
Can't wait. Inga Van Bell there, partner in executive search and assessment at Stanton Chase and soon to be author. And Emma Jordan, the CEO at Infinite Consulting. Hello and welcome back to Afternoons. Not with Helen Farmer today, with me, I'm Jen Crichton. We're talking about something that's a bit tricky now, discipline, particularly with regards to our kids. And I'm not immune to a bit of shouting. I wish I was. I try my best. But to be honest, the exasperation, I would describe it as probably, is very real sometimes when it comes to our kids and them not listening and you're just trying to get out the door and get things done. And I think that kind of, the levels of discipline perhaps look quite different in a lot of homes. But the reason we're talking about this today is because there is a new UNICEF study that has just been published, and it suggests that nearly 400 million children under the age of 5 have experienced what they describe as violent physical or psychological discipline at home. Now, that's roughly 60% of under fives. And what's more, researchers for that UN body found that one in four caregivers thinks physical discipline is sometimes necessary to instill a sense of right or wrong in our kids. So are they right, or is there another way? We're going to be getting into whether there is such a thing as positive discipline and what it might look like. So I'm joined now by parenting coach Aisha Mohammed. Aisha, hello. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, hello, hello everybody. My pleasure, my pleasure.
I mean, before we move on, let's just start with this study, because I was quite taken aback by those figures. Does that level of discipline for what are very young kids, really, does that surprise you, the scale of that?
Of course, of course. In this era and generation where we all are aware, unlike the past eras or the centuries, I would say, it is shocking.
What would you say, as an expert in this field, would be classified as harmful? I mean, I think we all know what the phrase violent physical discipline there. We can immediately say that's a no-go, especially when we're talking about under fives. I think everyone would be fairly horrified by that statistic. But when we get into what they're calling psychological discipline, I think maybe it's a bit less clear. What do we mean when we talk about psychological discipline and where it's harmful?
Of course, this is like, especially, let me get first, like discipline is part of parenting, right? Like we all need to discipline our children. But what as adults, what we need to understand is the meaning of discipline. Discipline means to teach in simple language, if I'm trying to tell you, like, and it's not punishing, you know, which we associate. So especially for younger children, right? Like it does have a psychological effect when it is a violent approach. When I say violent approach, it is like hitting and punishing, anger, threats. Always, it does have a long-lasting psychological effect on the children, which runs into their teens, adolescents, and even older, you know, as they get old.
I feel like it's trying to effectively get a black and white answer to something that is inherently grey. But is there a line at which it becomes harmful? You know, because I think probably, if we're honest, as parents, most of us have lost our calm to some degree or another. And that's kind of, I think, to be expected, where you maybe aren't as calm as you would like to be. But where does it get into the realms of it being a problem?
See, of course, we all are human beings, right? And of course, we are not perfect. We will lose our calm once in a while. But of course, losing calm is not the thing, but the repair work after it. That's where it counts as well. And when it comes to the damage, I would say rather is on a consecutive basis. Like, for example, if the child is being harmed or having all violent approaches, kind of like when it comes to discipline, on a daily basis or, you know, on frequent times, of course, it will have a really crazy effect on the child's brain, you know, a psychological effect. When I mean, it's like, it's really harmful.
You said something that I thought was really key, which was we sometimes mistake discipline with punishment. Those are two very different things, aren't they, that we
absolutely
tend to confuse?
Absolutely. It's two different things because we associate discipline to be punish or maybe harsh that way. Of course, we can positively discipline our children, you know, but that's how we have been. So we need to step up and make a change to our children and our the coming generation. Of course, we are in an era where there is enough knowledge in the click of a mouse.
And Aisha, you were talking about kind of there is a big difference between discipline and punishment. And you were just telling me it's about how we engage with our kids. What does effective discipline achieve and what does it look like?
Of course, like you said, punishment, discipline is somehow we relate it to, you know, being harsh or rude. But of course, we can positively discipline our children. So the first and foremost, I would say is connection is the key, right? Connection right from the beginning, even with infants, you know, connection is the key. So that takes us to connection versus correction, you know. So we often tend to correct our children than connecting. The more we connect, the more they're going to be listening to us. Even if it's a little time, it's not about the quantity. It's about the quality of time we are with our children. And of course, there's a self-regulation, which matters.
And you also mentioned before about when we acknowledge our own mistakes, that we're not always going to get it right. We're not always going to stay calm. And one of the things that I've noticed, particularly when we get into kind of these topics on social media and you get into that online debate space, there's always someone who goes, I'm only human. You can't expect me to be perfect. And I don't think it is about being perfect, but how do we make up for it? How do we acknowledge our own mistakes and sort of model that behaviour for our kids so that they know we're not perfect, but we're doing our best and that's a healthy way to be?
Of course. See, we, like you said, we are not perfect, right? We all are human beings. We make our mistakes. And sometimes with kids, we might even lose our calm. Sometimes. But when we lose our calm, how do we cover up? That's the repair work. Of course, we need to apologize. We need to go to them, you know? And what we did, like, for example, if you screamed out of your lungs, of course, we acknowledge that, right? Like, yes, dear, you know? Of course, not at the heat of the situation. Yeah, that's not going to work that way. Especially when the child is heated up, the situation is heated up. Once everything is calming down, find a time between you and your child when you can sit down and talk about it. That's what. And it does work out. It does have an effect on the child.
We've got a caller on the line, Miras. Miras, you've got a question for Aisha. Hello, how are you?
Hi, Jen. Hi, Aisha. How are you?
We're good, thank you. What's your question for Aisha?
My question is, I want to say I love the part where you differentiated between discipline and punishment, which is something we don't think about very often. I want to ask you, like, I have a 3-year-old daughter who's in the phase of saying no to everything, literally everything, even the things that she wants, like ice cream. First day she said no, but then she'll think about it for a minute. But yeah, basically, she says no to everything, and I don't want to punish her for having an opinion and speaking out her thought, but sometimes it gets really hard, especially as you said, when you're trying to walk out the door in the morning.
I understand that. I can totally, you know, figure that situation which you're going through, you know. And to be honest, you said your child is like 3-year-old, right?
And this
is
something, yeah, 3 and a half.
Yeah, this is something very common in that age group, actually, you know, to say the no word, you know. But another thing is, the more we say no, and that itself, like as adults, if we are saying no, they would do the no as well, you know. And another thing is, of course, when you are putting in a boundary, we need to be very consistent about it. What happens with us adults is when the child throws up, you know, we were like, okay, just forget it and just give the thing out, you know, we lose it up, right? And that's where the win-win situation for the child happens, you know. That's where they are the smart ones, you know, and they pick up that, and that's the thing, that's the key they use the next time. You know, so I would rather say, right, you like anytime your child is like throwing, you know, of course, no, you need to acknowledge her. Like, just say, I know you want that ice cream. You know, I know that, you know, that's enough for them, actually. You know, when you keep doing that on a repetitive basis, I'm telling you, it's going to win.
I love what you said as well, Miras, about, you know, you want her to have an opinion. And I think that's so important, isn't it? Is finding that balance where we can encourage our kids to have a voice and to have independence, but exactly, also still feel like we've got a bit of control of the situation.
Of course, we're the parents, right? We do have the control, you know. We do have the control over our kids, you know. So we need to decide, like, let's formulate on our side. Do we want to give that stuff or no? And then proceed, you know. So let's set ourselves calm down, because what happens is when a child throws in, we also, you know, shoot up. We lose our calm, and that's where it goes down, you know.
Does that answer your question, Miras?
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling. It was lovely to speak to you. Thank you, Miras. We've had a voice note here. This is Nika. She's a mum of three. She sent us this message.
My husband and I are opposites on how we discipline our kids. Like, my husband is the strict disciplinarian with an authoritative command, where my kids would just froze. But I won't say in direct fear. I mean, they won't froze in direct fear, but more like they realize the consequences with one stern look of their dad. And for me, I am more on the talking or discussing type. We talk about their behavior and how they feel, and I kind of help them to regulate their emotions and understand the impact of it and help them navigate on how to control it. So probably next time they would understand, or they would already know what they have to do. But of course, I can say that I don't lose my coolness. I mean, I don't lose my cool. I do sometimes, but I always try to keep in mind to balance with my husband, as he is already the strict one in our household. But in general, for me, kids still need to respect authority, and this is what they learn through the discipline of their dad. I mean, for my kids at least. And with me, they can be open, they can express how they feel or think, and we can talk about it. So I think find a balance, and that is how it works in our family.
Really interesting stuff. I would imagine there's probably a lot of people listening, Aisha, who would sympathise with that a bit. Is that really common that you've got kind of two parents with quite different styles of parenting?
Of course, of course. We all, like, especially when we are married or when you are coming into a relationship, you come from a different background, right? And you've been grown up in a different background as well. So you carry that load with you. So now when you are a parent by yourself, of course, you would be used to the kind you were, unless you want to make a change, unless you want to be like, oh, that's not a good stuff, I need to change. And then you work on it. It's more like, you know, you try to heal yourself, you know, before you jump in. You don't want to pass on to your children. But, you know, well, it's not the case with everyone, right? So, yeah, of course, there is a difference between the mother and the father. But it's all about the balance. It's all about, like, I love the thing which she said that, you know, she openly talks, and then, you know, you can be the mother. You are the mother and you can do that, right? Well, when it's the father, you, like you said, the father is the strict. The kids understand that, you know, the kids know. So what we need to understand is kids really know where is the loophole to get the things done. So, you know, we need to be on an alert button, I would say. Like, they know, okay, if I do this, I want to get this. Okay, there's the loophole. Let me go there. This is the trick on the trick I would navigate through to get that thing done. So that's where we as adults, we lose it.
Yeah, they're smart, aren't they, kids? Like, my son knows that when I say it's bedtime. And I will see him sneak back out of his room and chase down his dad to start a game, to roughhouse. And he knows full well that if he goes and kind of makes a silly face at his dad or rolls a car across the floor out of his bedroom door, that he's going to get a laugh and it's going to turn into more conversation. And he plays his dad like a fiddle at bedtime. And I see it coming, and you kind of, it's endearing. But also, by the time it's sort of the fourth or fifth time of coming out of his room, you just think, for the love, will you not just go to bed, please?
I can actually picture that scenario.
I mean, as parents, like, at what point is that? I guess every household is like that, in that the parents have different kind of roles. But at what point does that become a difficult thing? At what point do you have to say, okay, do you know what? We're maybe diverging a bit too much. We maybe need to meet in the middle somewhere.
So basically, when it comes to, like, a really harsh, fear-based discipline when we use, yeah, that's where, because that has an effect on the child as well. Because come on, who can work or who can actually run their day with stress in the head? Let's just take it to ourselves as well, as we adults. Can we have, like, work like a normal day if you're stressed? Same applies to children, you know? What we face, what we go through, it's the same thing with the children, the feelings, the behaviors. So what I try to say is, see, we can't control the behavior of the child, right, as such, but we can actually navigate it. Like, we can actually navigate the behavior, or even how they respond, how we respond to their behaviors is what matters.
And I mean, in that regard, I guess it's very hard to talk about discipline with regards to parenting in a way that's very black and white, because it's a very individualized thing, isn't it, to the parents and to the child. What will work for one child will not necessarily work for the other. Are there sort of universal rules, or is it a case of you need to very much look at your individual kids and say, this kid responds very well to sort of positive reinforcement, this child needs a more boundaried approach? Is it very much child by child?
Yeah, of course, because, like, I always use, take your hands, like your fingers, right? All your five fingers are in the same, is it? No. Same with your kids. Your kids can't be the same kind of behaviors, or can't have the same kind of mentality, the way they navigate things. We do have different kinds of children as well, you know. So it's same, you know. So we need to see what kind of technique or strategy can work with one child, may not work with the other child. So it's absolutely the parent. We need to understand that and then proceed, you know, navigate through it.
Keep your messages for Aisha coming. Send us your questions, 4001 on the text. I've not got a name on this one, but someone has messaged saying, how on earth do we handle it when our kids are just so furious that they just can't? And I think there's always that temptation, isn't there? When your kids are getting really furious and riled up and they're shouting, that's when it can become quite hard to keep your own cool, which of course is exactly when you should, right?
Yeah, exactly, you know. So it's basically like, let's take this way. When you have a fire, right? Like, do we put more fire into it? No, we put water to calm down, right? That's the exact thing how it works. So you want to calm the situation down? If we are not regulated, let's step back, pause ourselves, step back, rather than just, you know, throwing blunders from our mouth or the way we react, because that's going to have the effect on the child as well. It's just going to get worse. So if we are not at the moment we are, because sometimes it happens, right? Like even we just lose it. So it's better when we are in the moment, it's better to pause. Just take a breath in, step back, and then come back in when you are fine, you know?
And I mean, why do kids, do you think, get so furious? Like, at what age is it about it's exerting independence? At what age does it become something that we should be concerned about? What should we be looking for when our kids are that angry to know how to correctly respond? Because obviously we need to be calm, but in terms of actually answering the need that they have, how can we tell what they actually need? Because sometimes when your kids are furious, it's really hard to work out what exactly is going on, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because the thing is, firstly, we need to understand children, their brain is not developed. It is underdeveloped brains. Whereas we adults, we have developed brains. And then we are acting the same way as the children. Now you can imagine the difference, right? Like, you know, maybe a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old and equals to a 30-plus or a 40-plus of adults, one and the same if you behave. Like, it doesn't make sense, right? So we as adults, we need to understand. So when a child is throwing a tantrum, we need to calm ourselves. We need to work on ourselves for that. So that's the main thing, you know, for calmness. Like, we need to understand. Just remind yourself, it's not an attack on me, you know, just repeat. It's not an attack on me. It's just that when a child is throwing a tantrum, just take it as this way. The child needs help. We need to help them, you know, even if the screams or the screeches or lying on the floor, the meltdowns or whatever.
I do not miss that phase. The meltdowns in the supermarket are tough, aren't they?
Yeah. So that's where the boundary comes in action, you know. So where are we forming the boundary? For example, now if I'm taking my own son as well. So we have, like, I know, like, when do we have a candy, especially when it comes to chocolates, right? So yeah, so that's the boundary. Yeah, honey, we can't have that right now. It's the way you put it, you know, the tone, the language. Your body language itself counts as well. It's just not, you know, the voice, even the body language.
And I mean, you mentioned before trying to avoid using the word no too much, which I think is very tricky. What does that look like? How do we kind of redirect the conversation so that we are doing what we need to do without actually saying no to our kids and effectively just hitting that sort of head-butting moment, the flash point, I guess.
Absolutely. So see, now when we want to say no, right, even how would we like to be heard, like, no? Absolutely. So that's the same thing, you know. So when you want to say a no, like, it's, of course, it's the boundary you place. If, for example, now you want to go out and you say, please wear the red shoes. And they're like, no, I want to wear the blue shoes. No, it's a tug of war, which is happening, right? So kids love to have an authority. So when you can give in, please give in, you know, when it's going to not harm anybody, right? Mm. They like to have authority as well. Well, in times, like, instead of saying a no, like, don't touch that, don't do this, don't do that, you know, it's all no. It can be really overwhelming for the child as well. So instead, turn your questions around, you know. You can do this, dear, you know. How about doing this, you know, instead of just directly saying don't touch that, how about taking this, you know. So that's the way to, you know, navigate through it.
So sort of redirecting their attention.
Yeah, which one and the same means, like, okay, don't do that, do this kind of a thing. But it's the vocabulary we use, that's where.
And of course, Miras's daughter is 3. And I think at that age, we're kind of used to kids that are just coming into their independence. You know, absolutely. No is a way of exerting themselves in a way. But once you get into older kids where they're maybe a bit more aware and you maybe expect them to be a bit calmer, I think it can sometimes be harder to stay calm. When do you know if you're dealing with a strong-willed child and when it's just a developmental milestone? Is that kind of, is there a certain age at which they start to understand a bit more about when they're saying no and why?
Every stage, our children go through different stages. Now, when we are dealing with toddlers, or you know, it's a different strategy we need to use. And when it's like preteens and teens, that's a different section, I would say, category, I would say, rather. So it's all about how we understand our child and how we navigate. It can't be the same with every child. Even be it if I have like 3 or 4 kids, it's not the same with all the child. Like you said, strong-willed child, it's a different strategy we need to use as well, you know. We need to understand. But connection is the key. That starts from infants, I would say, you know. Connection is key. Even if it's like 15 minutes with your child, like a one-on-one time, that does have a big impact on your children.
I think it's really easy as well for us all to sort of talk about this in an ideal world, how we would like to act. But I think sometimes we don't acknowledge how much our own upbringings, our own background, even our own levels of stress and how busy and perhaps overwhelmed we are on any given day.
Absolutely.
Kind of influence our parenting. Sometimes I open my mouth and my mum comes out and it's kind of horrifying. To what degree do we need to be looking at ourselves and recognising patterns before we sort of put them onto our children, as it were?
I would say the pause trick, the pause technique, like before we just pour out onto our child, just like pause when you know that, you know, the breathe technique, like you just breathe in and breathe out. I would rather say fill your emotional cup as a parent. That's when you are regulated, you can actually regulate the child as well. But if you are not regulated, how can you?
Amazing stuff. Parenting coach Aisha Mohammed there. Aisha, I've got 20 seconds left with you. If people want to find you, where can they find you?
Yeah, so I do have my Instagram page. It's called Parenting Moments. It's from Parenting Moments, and then via email, so WhatsApp, yeah.
Amazing stuff. Thank you so much, Aisha. Hello and welcome back to Afternoons with Jennifer Crichton. Today I'm standing in for Helen. And next up, we're talking about an idea that is very new to me indeed. The sort of the word of the day is epigenetics. I know. I didn't know what it meant either. Simply put, it is a sort of emerging area of study, and it suggests that our experiences don't just influence our behaviour, but they can also actually change our genetic makeup. And that means that we can pass our experiences on to our kids. Now, we started looking at this subject because the actress Rebel Wilson wrote and gave an interview recently about how she avoided relationships for decades because she felt kind of so scarred by her parents' divorce. But now new scientific research is suggesting that it goes a lot further than that, to the point that we're seeing attitudes to food, for example, being presented by people generations on from their ancestors having lived through famine. So it's the suggestion is that actually our experiences can physiologically change us as human beings in a way that then passes down through our lineage. And so I guess what we want to explore really is this a good thing, or should we be worried about it? I'm joined now by therapist Kimberly Glasby. Kimberly, thank you for joining me. How are you?
Thank you for having me. This is a wonderful opportunity. I am feeling wonderful.
It's great to have you. I wonder, is this the term epigenetics, is this something that you are sort of familiar with, or do you tend to refer to it more as generational trauma or generational influence in your practice?
We probably refer to it more as generational trauma. It's just a more general term that can help people understand, you know, in layman's term, that generationally there can be trauma passed down.
And so is this sort of a known thing? Is this very common? Do we see it a lot?
You know what? I think it's been kind of a new wave topic, like from COVID, that brought up so many mental health issues that people started to look into where some of their issues were coming from.
Oh gosh, that's really interesting. So people sort of that maybe had not previously struggled with their mental health started to find that they were exhibiting patterns that they maybe recognized?
Yeah, I mean, when you spend a lot of time alone with yourself,
yes,
you tend to recognize things, you know. Also, if you're spending a lot of time with your spouse or your children that you wouldn't normally, you know, spend on a regular basis, then some of those things start to come up. Like your spouse is reminding you constantly to do certain things and you're like, oh my gosh, I forgot again. Oh, just like my dad. He always forgot things, you know. And so there's some things that you probably wouldn't have even paid attention to until there was time to do it.
And so, I mean, I think we all perhaps see, I don't know how you would describe, like echoes of our parents. I mean, I said just in the last segment when we were talking about parenting, sometimes I open my mouth and my mum comes out and I didn't intend it to happen. It just happens that way. We all know that kind of our upbringing can influence us in that way. But yeah. I think we always think of it as being a nature versus nurture debate. And this field of science suggests that actually it's more physiological than that.
Yeah, there have been studies to show that children can inherit trauma from their parents, even from their fathers being the fertilizer of the egg, can pass on some of those issues to their children. That's just like some other mental health disorders are inherited. So, yes, they are in your body. They're in your DNA.
And so that in terms of the trauma side of things, mm-hmm. that is the sort of lived experiences alter mm-hmm. us in such a way as we pass it on?
Yeah. If you look at populations that dealt with natural disasters, let's say, it would be shown that the generation after the one that lived it would actually experience PTSD more often than the one that experienced it because it's been passed down genetically. And then there are also those different patterns that they show in the way that they deal with life. And they're passing that on to their children. It can be unhealthy ways of coping. And then they're passing that on. Or either children watch more than they listen. So they're paying attention to maybe an avoidant parenting style or love attachment style. And then it just carries on through their social interactions.
Gosh, that's so interesting. And how does that manifest? How would we recognize it in our kids? Because, of course, when our kids are younger, they're mm-hmm. not necessarily displaying particular issues in the same way as we might. They're mm-hmm. not demonstrating that trauma in the same way as it might affect you or I. But how do we see that perhaps they are picking up on it?
I've heard parents talk about the two children that they have. The one child, there's two in one. At school, the teachers go, oh, they are amazing. They're the perfect little student. They're never talking, never misbehaving. They're so respectful. And they get home and everything comes off. And they're throwing tantrums and they're yelling and they're being disrespectful to their parents and they can't follow directions. Parents pay attention to that because what could be happening is a reaction to some trauma that their child is not being able to handle, that the parent absolutely is projecting onto the child. So I've seen couples that have issues with, you know, disagreements in the way that they communicate, and the child will exhibit anger issues at school. They're hitting their friends. They are, you know, yelling and being disrespectful again. And then I talk to the parents and they're, yeah, we're having trouble at home. And then when you think about it and we talk about it some more, and my parents had the same issue. So my husband and I have been trying to find better ways to communicate with each other. And then I help them understand how their children are actually responding to those behaviors.
Kimberly, you were saying before there that, you know, we pass these things on to our kids sometimes unwittingly. And I guess it's that phrase that I kind of, it makes me think of, is that hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. If this is changing us on a physiological level, though, how do we avoid passing that on? Is it about how we deal with things in the moment to make sure that they don't affect us to such a degree that we end up passing it on?
Absolutely. I am a mindfulness instructor as well. It has helped me in my life so much. I'm a big advocate for that because mindfulness helps you be present, to stay in the moment and be aware of how you're reacting to your feelings and the world around you at all times. So one thing that people can do is learn those coping strategies of when things come up, how do I deal with them? Is it in a healthy way? Am I going to go exercise because my stress level is up? Or am I going to sit in front of the TV and eat until I gain weight and then I get hypertension? And then that's something I'm going to pass down as well. Or am I going to go and speak to a therapist because I'm having so many thoughts that I can't process them on my own? So being mindful at all times can help you process better, and then you're not passing down those unhealthy traits.
So it's about modeling, essentially, trying Absolutely. To show our kids that difficult things will happen, bad things will happen, that Yes. we will have hurdles, but how we deal with them in a way that we model to our kids.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's not hopeless then, this suggestion that our bad experiences are going to be passed on. But I mean, you mentioned big life-changing experiences. And I mean, everyone alive right now just lived through a pandemic. That yeah. was a hugely influential thing for a lot of us. And as you mentioned at the start here, that brought up a lot for a lot of people. A lot of people started to see where their own coping mechanisms were perhaps lacking.
Yeah.
What sort of impact do we expect that experience is going to have on our children? Because, I mean, my son was 4 when we went into lockdown for the first time. I guess a lot of children have grown up with that in a way that we didn't have to experience in those formative years.
Well, I was a school counselor, and what we noticed is after we came back to school full time, that those children that were in their developmental stages in building their social interactions and learning how to interact healthily with their peers missed that time. So when they came into school full time, they didn't really know how to interact with each other. A lot of them did talk with each other, but it was online. They would just text each other or something. But being in the room, sitting next to someone, not knowing how to share space, that's what we saw. And the thing moving forward, I think, is going to be recognizing how it impacted us, really. And what myself and my co-counselors used to say is, okay, everyone wants to say we went back to normal. There is no normal. We have to recognize that this was a worldwide situation and it impacted everyone in similar and in different ways.
Gosh, it's a topic that I imagine we could speak about for hours. We're sadly out of time. If people want to find you, Kimberly, how would they find you on social media?
Well, I am at official Kimberly Glaspie on Instagram. You can also contact me at MCM Dubai Mental Health Center. We're just here in Al Barsha, in Barsha Heights. So, yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to the show. As you can hear, I am not Helen, I'm Jen Kryson. I'm in for her this week. And we're talking about a headline now that really grabbed my attention. There's something that I didn't really realise that perhaps we had a shortage of here in Dubai, but apparently we're getting some more millionaires. 6,700 of them, to be precise. I'd love to know how they calculate this. But this is a new study that suggests that they are moving to the UAE this year. That's right, 6,700 new millionaires moving this year, which puts the Emirates at the top of all of the countries in the world in terms of attracting high net worth individuals. So, is it good news? What does it mean for the rest of us? Does it mean we're going to have to pay more for stuff, essentially, is what I want to know. I am joined in the studio, first up, by concierge to the rich, Thea Kears. Thea runs Butterfly Social. Thea, how are you?
Yes, very well, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I don't know how this number has been calculated, but I found it fascinating how precise it is. 6,700 new millionaires coming in. Does that surprise you?
Not particularly. I think it's actually kind of the third year we've seen this kind of massive growth to the region. Obviously, America is still very popular and used to be the sort of target area for millionaires. But obviously, we've seen the dynamic shift of kind of the luxury spectrum move and have a much more of a focus towards the Middle East. Certain reasons for that I suppose we'll go into. I mean, real estate being one in particular. Stability, safety, and all the other things that we kind of, I suppose, sometimes take for granted living here as well. I suppose that is attracting everyone from around the globe.
Now, it's very interesting that you mentioned real estate first off the bat there, because I also have a second guest joining us on the phone. Paul Sharland is Associate Director of Off Plan and Investment at House & House. Paul, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Does this surprise you, first up? And also, do we have enough houses for 6,700 new millionaires? Is there enough luxury property out there for them?
First of all, it doesn't surprise me at all. I think it was definitely going to happen, and it's going to continue to happen. I don't think there is enough property. No, I don't think they can actually build fast enough. I think certainly the luxury property segment, with the amount of millionaires moving here, I think they actually need to build more.
Gosh. So, I mean, I look around and I see lots of lovely big houses, but presumably if you are a high net worth individual moving into the country, you have quite specific idea of what you might be looking for. What would a high net worth individual coming to you typically be looking for from their new home in the Middle East?
With the high net worth, it's very different what their needs are. I mean, you have some where privacy is very important, and security. Now, obviously, there's no crime in Dubai, so you've got the security. They also want the privacy. But you've also got other people who like to be a bit flash, bit of Las Vegas, maybe want somewhere on the par, maybe in Royal Atlantis. You know, they want that trophy asset.
Trophy asset. Goodness me. Thea, does that chime with what you see here and what people are looking for in the Middle East? And has it changed, I guess? You've been here a number of years now. Has it shifted?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it's quite difficult from that perspective because I completely understand that some people do want the kind of show-off lifestyle. But we are seeing the fact that kind of more people are moving here for the reason that there's great schooling. It's brilliant to raise children here. You're so close to traveling and going to wonderful destinations. And then obviously the realistic kind of aspect of the fact that, you know, you can have a great quality of life. You don't essentially have to have that flashy side. But we do know still people that do. It's just personal preference. There's no generic person that likes it. There's, you know, everyone likes a bit of this and that now and again. And, you know, that's what concierge is all about, to try and find it if you want it. And we can help you be as flashy as you want or as private as you like as well.
I mean, Paul, you mentioned that we can't build fast enough here at the moment. I mean, we're seeing a huge amount of building going on. But when you're talking about sort of off-plan property, is it a select amount that is actually for the sort of high net worth category? Is a lot of the housing that's going up for more ordinary budgets?
Yes, I mean, apart from the high net worth moving here, there's just a huge amount of people from around the world moving here. Particularly families from Europe who are, you know, from the UK, they're fed up with their own countries, whether that's the war, whether that's immigration, whether that's tax, whether it's crime. So there's got to be a whole range of property available. I mean, you've got, you know, single people here who might want a one bedroom, and you've got your high net worth who might want a six bedroom villa on the palm. I mean, but they're building for everyone. They're building apartments, townhouses and villas to suit all tastes and needs and budgets.
And I mean, that's one thing for people who can buy. But of course, a lot of us here still rent. What sort of impact does this continuing influx into the city have on those rents? Because I think a lot of people have been kind of biding their time thinking, hopefully those rents, those property prices are going to come down soon. And of course, this suggests that that might be wishful thinking.
Well, I mean, this is one of the reasons why they're building so much property, because the reason rents go up is because of supply and demand. So if there's more people moving here than what they've got property, rents are going to rise. So one of the reasons they're building all this property is because of all the people moving here. And that's, as I said, that's from your 20-somethings doing IT or finance to your people who are going to retire here to your high net worths. It's a whole range and a mix of people.
And is that, when you're talking about people buying off plan as well, presumably they're looking to stay here for quite some time. But are there people who now buy, even if they're not sure if they're staying, people who are buying because they still see the Middle East as being a good long-term investment, even if they decide personally to move on?
Yeah, I mean, I think Dubai, you know, Dubai is seen as the Switzerland of the Middle East, if you like. It's a safe haven. It's, you know, it's one of the busiest real estate markets in the world. I mean, when you look at the price, the average price per square foot, I mean, Dubai ranks about 90th in the world. I mean, it's not even in the top 50.
Wow.
But the actual average price, I mean, you're looking at a one-bed apartment from sort of £220,000 to €250,000. So there's something for everyone.
Gosh, it doesn't feel that way sometimes, though, does it? It feels very expensive.
There's going to be your absolute prime areas. There's going to be your Mayfairs and Kensingtons. There's going to be your downtowns and the Palm, your Dubai Hills. But there's also going to be your JVCs, your Arjans, and, you know, something for everyone. That's what Dubai is aiming to do, and I think they'll achieve it.
And at what point do we get to sort of say, well, actually, we've not got enough property right now to meet the needs, and when people need to sort of start compromising on what they might be looking for?
Well, I think what I like about Dubai is they always look at, you know, they always look at the headwinds and they think, right, what's coming up and what can we do? You know, we know they're building lots more roads, they're building lots more interchanges, they're building a lot more property. You know, there's a big undersupply of bigger units. You know, I mean, villas and townhouses in Dubai, they only make up 13% of the property. You know, there's 87% apartments. There's also, you know, there's a great deal of studios and one beds, but there's not as many two and three beds. So with families here, you know, we see it as for the investor looking for the opportunities. I mean, they're abundant here.
Oh, wow. So it's kind of where we might be seeing a bit of a crush in demand and supply is more in the two, three bedroom family side of things then.
Yeah. So, you know, we're speaking to a lot of people, particularly in Europe at the moment, always the UK, but Germany, France, Holland, Italy, you know, and the general feeling is that they don't want to raise their kids through high school in their own countries. And they're looking around the world. They're looking at the different options. And time again, Dubai's coming top for a mountain of reasons. You know, it's very safe, the education system, no tax, everything. There's just so many reasons to be here.
A huge amount of appeal. I guess it means it's a very busy time for you guys still then. It's not really quietening down going into the summer, Paul.
No, well, I mean, I came here in 2005 and I could say that last year was the first year that we actually remained busy through July and August. I mean, even the year before, I mean, up until June in 2022, it was busy, but then it went quiet again until September. So if it continues again this year, then that'd be the second year where we've had all-round business.
Absolutely fascinating stuff there. Paul Sharland, Associate Director of Off-Plan and Investment at House & House. So that's the property side of things. We're going to be staying with this topic and Thea Kearse is staying with me. And Thea, I'm guessing it's not just property that people coming in are looking for. What is it that these incoming families think the UAE has to offer that suits them so well?
I mean, we take a lot of it for granted, those of us who've been here for a long time. I think Paul touched on things really, really well when obviously he mentioned everything from schooling to safety and so on and so forth. But I think from here, the three main things that we look for that are kind of really quite stand out as investment opportunities that obviously work alongside not just the UAE, but the GCC as a region as well. There's a multitude of opportunities, particularly if you're coming over from the US or Europe as well. It breaches your business or maybe your own personal wealth to be able to invest into businesses that you might not have been exposed to before. You also look at spend, investment, spend and enjoyment. They're my kind of like key three that we sort of support. Spend is very different from investment. And what you get here, you know, everybody wants their experiences and everything that goes on for them, whether it be schooling or other things that you spend money on, to be of quality. You don't want to spend your money frivolously. You want to make sure that you are spending on high quality. If you go out for dinner, you have a great experience. You're spending on things that you feel are worthwhile. And then, of course, the main factor, which is kind of enjoyment as well. The diversity of what you can do here on a day-to-day basis, because Dubai is such a great, it's such an easy to get around 20 minutes from everywhere for a completely different experience. So those kind of three factors, I think, are really, really key to what people want from being here.
Do you know, it's really interesting. I always think that the safety side of things is maybe underplayed a bit. I was out with friends the other night and we left and I got in the car and I was driving home and then thought, gosh, I just left my mates at 1 a.m. and nobody said,
message me when you're home. Like, there isn't that fear that we have at home of everyone getting home safely. And some of my friends were getting taxis, some of them were using sort of safe driver services, and nobody seemed remotely concerned about anyone getting home. And I think we maybe underplay the impact that that can have for a lot of us, that feeling that we are safe as we go about our day-to-day lives. And that's not unique to high net worth individuals. That's something that everyone here benefits from, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's quite unique in the fact that you can kind of play on that, because there are a lot of people that come here that are celebrity status, extremely wealthy and powerful within their own right or within the certain business sectors and market, that do have a certain level of privacy, because people aren't really kind of like hounding celebrities or people here. There's, because there is that certain makeup, and certainly within specific communities, people feel really safe and they don't feel like they have to be pressured to do anything or be anyone within their own right. They can just relax. That's a huge factor, definitely.
And in terms of the schools as well, that's something that, I mean, so many of the schools at the moment are very busy. We're seeing a lot of waiting lists. Is that an area where we're still seeing increased demand? I know there's a number of new schools being built at the moment.
It seems so, yes. The private sector for schooling is just booming. I personally don't have children, so it's not my area of expertise. I'm terrible. But I do know certainly schools are pushing and pushing to have the best results they can have. And then obviously we do bring this up quite a lot, but school fees seem to keep going up and up every single year. So yet again, that demand is obviously there. Like Paul was saying, from real estate, there's a lot of demand. So we've got to just kind of keep building them and trying to maintain the standards as best as we can as well.
Gosh, it's absolutely fascinating. We could talk about it probably all day. And we didn't even get onto giant giraffes and,
oh, fun.
And unicorns and waterfalls.
Fun, unusual and things.
A conversation for another day, Thea. I love
crazy things
about
you want to build in your house.
Crazy things that Thea gets asked.
Wonderful art and architecture and all sorts.
That is a story for, I can't wait. That's one for another day.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Afternoons with Helen Farmer is live Monday to Friday, 2 till 5.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.